Monday, March 27th, a little after 9. I'm joined today by Senator Dyson, Senator Stedman, Co-Chair Wilken, and I'm Senator Green. We have a couple of pieces of legislation on the agenda today. Senate Bill 310 and Senate Bill 189. Senate Bill 289 will not be heard today. And a little more work left to do. It's postponed at least until tomorrow. We'll begin with Senate Bill 310. Welcome, Darwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Darwin Peterson, staff to Co-Chair Senator Green. This morning, I'll give the committee a brief overview of Senate Bill 310, a bill that's sponsored by the Senate Finance Committee, dealing with the employment of prisoners. The Alaska Correctional Industries Program and the Commission were repealed on July 1, 2005, when the legislature allowed the program to sunset. The primary purpose of this legislation, then, is to provide the necessary statutory authority for the Department of Corrections to continue their inmate work programs. The bill provides the necessary statutory authority to participate in critical federal prison industry enhancement programs as well. It grants the authority to actively participate and partner with private enterprise. This is these are partnerships that will provide win-win opportunities for both the state and the private sector. Fiscally speaking, the prison employment program established by this legislation won't be a burden on the state's general fund, since the entire program will be funded through program receipts. Senate Bill 310 will allow the department to make a deduction from the offender's wages to also apply for the cost of confinement. Prison employment program is set up to allow inmates to work toward financial stability and responsibility by taking deductions from their wages to pay for child support, victim restitution, criminal fines, civil judgments, and even fees for their own utilities used in prison. Senate Bill 310 is a necessary piece of legislation if we want to keep our inmates working while incarcerated. That concludes my brief overview of the legislation, Madam Chair, and I'd be happy to answer questions. We also have folks from the Department of Corrections in the audience that can answer technical questions for the committee.
Are there any questions? Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate this bill coming forward. Portia or someone from the department, I would appreciate a chance to ask a question.
For the record, Charlene Griffin, Director of Admin Services for the Department of Corrections.
Yeah, thank you. The whole prison industries issue is one that's been of great interest to me for all the years that I've been here. And a few years ago, one of the problems was just exacerbated by the lack of space in the prisons and not being able to do a really good classification system that had long-term prisoners in one place, and therefore it made sense to invest in training them and so on and so forth. Have we made any progress on that issue?
It doesn't seem to be such an issue anymore. In Highland Mountain, we have the women's sewing shop, and we've just opened a men's sewing shop for the Meadow Creek side. We have a fairly large labor force there. I'm not sure exactly how many offenders were working, but even with some rotation, the inmates that are working can train other inmates, as well as the production managers being able to train them. In Seward, we have the wood furniture shop, and we have a fairly stable long-term population in Seward. In Lemon Creek, we have the laundry industry and a sterile laundry program with Alaska Laundry and Dry Cleaners, and there doesn't seem to be a problem with the workforce and training there.
Thank you. That's encouraging. And I remember talking to, it was Parks and Rec, DOT, a few years ago about using prison labor for trail work and clearing a brush around stop signs and all of those sorts of things. And at the time, whoever I was talking to in one of those two organizations said it was almost more trouble than worth, because corrections wouldn't know on any given day how many people would be showing up and how many would be qualified, and it had been kind of a logistic problem for them. do we make prisoners, or can we make prisoners available on almost a day labor kind of an arrangement for doing that kind of work outdoors away from the site?
We can make them available. It does require some notice because obviously an institution is very, very scheduled. And if you're going to be taking inmates outside the perimeter of the institution, you want to make sure that they are classified appropriately and that staff are available to take them out to work.
Yeah, if it's not a problem for you, I would enjoy offline a bit of a report on, is any of that kind of work going on, and are inmates available for those kinds of things?
And I will follow up on that. I can tell you that in the last few years, we've done some brushing work for the Alaska Railroad. And we've done a lot of community service work up around Point McKenzie Correctional Farm. Mm-hmm. And offenders at Lemon Creek have painted some of the Douglas Island offices for the central office staff and things of that nature. So we have had inmates out doing community work in some areas.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really appreciate what you all are doing in that regard.
Thank you.
And Senator Dyson, that would directly be impacted by the level of whether it's medium, minimum, maximum, as to whether or not they're even available to leave the premises. So that would determine a lot of the availability as well. Are there other questions? Senator Stedman.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm just kind of curious, a little bit of background on what type of jobs and that the prisoners are doing, and what kind of percent of those prisoners come out of prison and maybe go into those areas and work, or is this just geared for something to occupy their time versus actually train them with more employable skills so they have a better opportunity to earn a living and become more productive citizens?
Mm-hmm. Char, you want to address that?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. I'm not sure what percentage of offenders go to work in the field that they've worked in a correctional facility. I can tell you, however, that these industries and these jobs that are done in institutions take care of inmate idleness, which is a problem. They also teach the offenders to be personally responsible for their financial debts, for getting up every morning, for taking personal responsibility of themselves. An offender can be fired from a job, and they will be fired from a job if they're not present at their station at starting time. It does teach them more responsibility, as well as its use for a management tool for the facility superintendents and correctional officers. Offenders with nothing to do become bigger problems.
Any further follow-up, Senator Stedman?
No, I'd just like to make a quick comment on it, though. I understand what she's saying. Years ago when I was in Oregon going to school, some of the students in the Votech area were coming from extended stays in the big house where they had learned some machinist skills and welding skills and mm-hmm. going through these other programs to get their two-year certificate because they didn't count them on it. Mm-hmm. Their last place of employment, mm-hmm. Which I think helped these individuals with a career ahead of them with the ability to make a reasonable income and support their family if they decide to stay on that side of the line versus the other one.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's always the goal, is to have part of that be part of the package. I'm not sure you can always inspire others with your own dream. That's in these settings. Are there any other questions? Is there any other thing? I know that we kind of allowed something to sunset that shouldn't have sunsetted last year, as I recall, and we have some money sitting there. And this is necessary to be able to move that money to the correct account. Is that not correct, Char?
Yes, it is. It's also necessary to continue inmate employment at all. With those statutes, that sunset was the provision for no obligation to workers' compensation for prison employment. Without this legislation, it's questionable as to how much prisoner employment will be able to do, because the state would be required to provide workers' compensation for inmate labor. This legislation also adds a few things in allowing us to participate in prison industry enhancement programs. They are certified through the Correctional Industries Association, which is supported by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. And these programs allow the state to go into business with private vendors to sell products across state lines. They have several requirements so that it doesn't create unfair competition with private vendors. They require that the state pay prevailing wage for those jobs, and that studies be done to see what the impact of these industries would be. And they allow for a cost of care if the offender is making prevailing wage, so that the offender can help support that program.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Is there anyone else who wished to testify? Come on up. Morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
You'd give your name and who you represent, please.
My name is Don Etheridge, and I represent the Alaska State AFL-CIO. We are supportive of the program itself, but we do have some current concerns with the piece of legislation as it's drafted. Our concerns are that it might open it up too far, with one person making the decisions of what minimal effects are on the current workforce. And we have some concerns over that it might expand too far and start putting people out of work that are already working. And we do support the work program. In fact, I've taken many people from the halfway house through the laborers and put them through training and put them out to work through the laborers when I was the business agent down there. So we are supportive of it, but that is our concern.
Is there also other statute that covers that?
I'm not sure.
If I could, through the chair.
It's a primary overriding. Go ahead, Char.
The Correctional Industries Association that administers the Prison Industry Enhancement Act for the federal government does have mandatory criteria. Part of that criteria is also that the labor unions be contacted, and that there not be an impact on labor unions or existing workers or whatever PI program is going to be run.
Okay. Do you have a copy of that requirements?
Yes, I do. I have one copy with me. I certainly could.
Rose can get us some copies
okay.
of that. And are you aware of that, Don?
No, I wasn't.
Yeah. So that may address your concerns.
Well, one of the concerns we do have has happened in the past, even with this stuff in place, is one of our concerns. We've had a lot of the brush cutting used to be done by union labor, and we don't do that no more because it was taken away years ago when the prisoner started doing that. And that's why we're concerned about this sort of stuff.
Well, I bet you could get back to brush cutting now, because I don't think there's enough people out there cutting brush to even make a drip in the bucket.
Well, the brush cutting, most of the brush cutting nowadays in the state is done by SAGA. The at-risk youth groups are doing it all over the state at this time. So, and
you have a lot of competition.
Yes, we do.
Yeah,
and it's what really bothers us about the competition is not fair competition.
Senator Sedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, the last couple of years, we've been heading down a road of putting out some pretty good capital bills, building up our workforce for the big project coming here in a decade or so. And I'm just wondering if I could get some feedback on the issue of the laborers, and particularly the laborers, that pool, and how the manpower is in that pool to facilitate the larger construction projects, if we're building schools, or we're building roads, or we're building bridges, versus the maintenance side of cutting brush, making license plates, that type of stuff. And is there a shortage in high demand, and having trouble filling the labor pool for the labor of the more skilled projects that we have coming? Or?
Through the chair, Ms. Senator Stedman. In some areas, yes, we're having troubles filling different positions in the higher levels of the labor workforce. We have expanded our apprenticeship programs. We're doing everything we can at this point to drag in more trained people that we can train through our apprenticeship programs to fill these other jobs that are coming up. And with the prospect of the upcoming major projects that we're looking at, we've increased the apprenticeship training statewide in all the fields of labor. Unbelievable the expansions that we've done as far as for training in the apprenticeship programs.
Did I answer your question, Senator Stedman?
I think it does. You know, it's kind of a tough issue, Madam Chair, because we've got people that are incarcerated that need to be occupied and need to learn job skills, and just the general work ethic of getting up in the morning and going to work, versus the normal labor pool, in this particular case, the labor union or the laborers on construction jobs. So we have to walk the balance, and we have to find something for these people to do. You know, I understand his concern that he wants to keep his workers busy, but we want to keep our inventory of incarcerations down. So we're trying to walk that balance.
And Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
We're in agreement with that. We want to see that. But is what our concern is when we start putting people out at minimum wage and taking jobs away from those that are working above minimum wage, you're not helping everybody at that point. The way we see it is that if you're taking a good job away from somebody to give it to somebody that's incarcerated, there's a chance that this other person could wind up incarcerated because they're going to do something stupid when their bills are due and they can't pay them. Mm-hmm. And that's where our concern comes in, too.
Are there further questions from Ms. Jethridge? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, move to report Senate Bill 310 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Without objection, Senate Bill 310 moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Next bill up, Senate Bill 189. And Senator Huggins, carry out. Welcome.
Good morning.
We also have Dwayne Bannock online.
Madam Chair, Charlie Huggins, Senate District H, Rural Matsu, Chugiak. This is about driver's licenses, not near as exciting as employment and how much you get paid for it, but it's important to our country and to our state. In this case, the state of Alaska doing its part. In May of 2005, President Bush signed the Real ID Act, which essentially puts down some principles that we have to comply with. And though this bill was in prior to President Bush signing that legislation, If you're legal in the United States of America, this doesn't have any real effect on you. If you're not, it will make your life miserable and you won't get a driver's license. And essentially, two scenarios. I think Mr. Dwayne Bannock is online with us, that you'll find that there's about 15 to 20 documents that Mr. Bannock will accept to get a driver's license. However, if he gives you a driver's license and you're in the United States of America for, as a college student, for about 1 year, at the end of 1 year, your driver's license will expire. That's what this bill does. In addition, if you have an indefinite visit to the United States of America from outside, then you have a one-year limitation on your licensing. So essentially, this bill makes it much, much more difficult, hopefully impossible, for somebody that is illegally in the United States of America to get a driver's license in the state of Alaska. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? It's interesting that this is being heard today when there was a huge demonstration and speech on immigration and illegal immigrants today in Washington, D.C. So there's not anything in here, though, that would require identification on the part of someone who's been here all their life, who's had licenses, who's...
No. As long as your license do not expire.
Okay, and who has a Social Security number?
That's correct.
And all those things.
That's correct. Doesn't change the status of those people at all.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Senator Stedman.
Well, just kind of for a lighter moment, I guess. Here, a year or so ago, I used the state-issued Senate ID card at the airport. They thought that was pretty humorous. Whatever that's worth, won't get us on the airplane.
A driver's license is very important when you're trying to get on the airplane.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, if I might add, if there is a side that can be spun to the negative on this sort of legislation, and really in reference to the president's legislation, is that some people are trying to make the case that this calls for a national ID. The rules that you see in place here for Alaska does not do that, doesn't hint at that, but that is one of the spins I've heard some people put on it.
Okay. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Huggins, on page 1, line 8, is a conditional resident alien, is that what we typically know as someone with a green card?
Hi. For the record, my name is Deborah Grenman, staff to Senator Huggins. Actually, I do have the definition for a conditional resident alien. A conditional resident alien may be granted permanent resident status on a conditional basis. Example, a spouse of a U.S. citizen, an immigrant investor who is required to petition for the removal of a set of conditions before the second anniversary of the approval of his or her conditional status. So I'm not familiar with any more definite immigrations. Maybe Dwayne can say, I don't know if that's a green card or not, but.
So read that again, Debbie.
A conditional resident alien is any alien granted permanent resident status on a conditional basis. The example is a spouse of a U.S. citizen and immigrant investor who is required to petition for the removal of the set of conditions before the second anniversary of the approval of his or her conditional status. And that's from information from the federal immigrations.
I'm sorry I asked. Yeah. Thank you.
And you should have that memorized by the next meeting. Or is there any other comments? We do have Dwayne Bannock and then Matthew Kerr. Dwayne, what can you tell us today? If you'd introduce yourself and give your title, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Dwayne Bannock. I'm with the Department of Administration, today representing the Division of Motor Vehicles. First off, thank you very much for hearing this bill. Thank you for allowing me to testify via telephone, and a special thank you to Senator Huggins and his staff for all the work that they've done in helping the Division of Motor Vehicles out with this bill. Senator Huggins did a pretty excellent job of explaining to you why this bill is important to the DMV. He hinted towards the fact that this is helping the Division of Motor Vehicles comply with the Federal Real ID Act. And I'll just break it down as simply as I possibly can into three groups. First off, if you get a driver's license, you must be a United States citizen. Part two of that, if you are not a United States citizen but can prove that you are indeed in America legally, then we treat you almost the same as a United States citizen. And the third part of this bill, to that second group of people that we treat almost like a United States citizen, if they are not United States citizens and are here for a minimum amount of stay or even an indefinite amount of stay, their expiration date will expire at a different time than yours and mine will. As again, as the senator mentioned, there's a lot of misinformation about the Real ID Act, and while this is just one part of the Real ID Act, based on past administration policies at the Division of Motor Vehicles, I'm pleased to tell you that Alaska is not that far off from being able to fully comply with the Real ID Act. You see, the majority of our policy has been driven largely by regulation, and that regulation is good regulation. This bill is simply taking a large chunk of that regulation and putting it into law. Madam Chair, that concludes my brief testimony. I would, if there are any questions, I'd be more than willing to entertain those.
Okay. Are there any questions for Dwayne Bannock? Thank you for calling in today, Dwayne, and giving us your testimony.
Thank you.
There's also testimony from Matthew Kerr. If you would give your name and who you represent, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Matthew Kerr, and I am a small business owner in South Anchorage, and I am only representing my own views today.
Go right ahead.
Thank you. Before I start, I would like to thank your office for facilitating my remote testimony today. I decided to take advantage of the long weekend from Juneau, and this is only the second time I have ever testified, so please forgive me if I sound nervous at all.
You're doing great.
Thank you. I'm here to state my opposition to Senate Bill 189. I believe that this bill, as well as the rest of the federal Real ID Act requirements, are all a very bad idea. Since this is the Finance Committee, I will frame my opposition in financial terms. First, it will cost money to train DMV employees as immigration agents and to deal with the increased paperwork. Immigration law is not always as simple as visa and passport, please, as I think we just heard in some earlier testimony. In one case I'm aware of, a foreign student would have needed to return to the DMV four times in the past 5 years to renew their license under the proposed regulations, and this cost everyone money and time. And I would like to ask, would you be able to determine the legal status of someone with an expired F1 student visa in an expired passport, an I-94 entry form marked valid for duration of status instead of a particular expiration date, and a valid I-20 form showing current enrollment at the University of Alaska? And can you imagine trying to convince doubtful DMV employees four times over 5 years? Personally, if I found myself in that situation, I would ignore the 90-day limit and continue to use my foreign license indefinitely. It is not cost-effective to train DMV employees as immigration agents versed in the finer points of immigration law, nor to require people to return sometime annually to renew their ability to drive. Second, there are costs to public safety. If someone was to decide to stay illegally, would you rather be on the road with an illegal alien that has passed the test to obtain a valid Alaska license, or an illegal alien, probably not insured, with a Russian license and no accessible driving record to law enforcement? I have personally driven the roads in Ukraine. This is an actual real risk to the general public, unlike some vague, convoluted terrorist threat that is supposed to correct. In addition to public safety, there will be more law enforcement and court costs dealing with more suspended licenses or canceled licenses, or expired licenses, I should say, for people that haven't actually committed any moving violations. Third, there is a huge potential data liability for the state. This is a field I am intimately familiar with. Part of my job is database administration and data security, and I work with sets of sensitive personal information for many of my clients, including my current contract with the state of Alaska. And while not explicitly covered by Senate Bill 189, part of the Federal Real ID Act mandates that states retain electronic copies of the documents used to obtain a driver's license and opens up direct electronic access to DMV records from other states. This concept absolutely horrifies me. The DMV here does have good security, but nothing is impenetrable. You don't necessarily need to be hacked. All it takes is a single disgruntled employee or contractor walking out of the building with a nightly backup tape in his back pocket and posting a copy on the internet, or someone at the Puerto Rico DMV might decide that he could make some better money selling copies of legitimate birth certificates and social security cards, courtesy of our DMV records. After that happens, you can find and prosecute the person responsible, but you can't put the genie back in the bottle. When it happens, it will be bad enough. I definitely don't want images of my documentation of legal presence being sold in Tijuana for $5,000 a pop. The more sensitive electronic data you connect and collect in one place, the worse the fallout will be from an inevitable security breach. This is a realistic scenario. There's one very good example in current news. Last Friday, the Anchorage Daily News had an article titled Financial Institutions Issue Check Card Warning, showing that debit cards of thousands of Alaskans were compromised due to a security breach at Visa, thousands of miles away. Nationally, Wells Fargo and Washington Mutual Bank had to reissue over 200,000 ATM cards due to a software flaw that went unnoticed for years. Flawed software was written for financial institutions that paid for the most extensive security audits that money can buy. Finally, I'm almost done here, I just don't see the point in doing all of this. A driver's license is not an immigration document. I could use a foreign passport, regardless of visa expiration, to board a domestic flight, just like the terrorist did, or to open a bank account. I could legally use a foreign driver's license, even with an expired visa, as long as I leave and return to Alaska once every 3 months. Personally, I would rather have my law enforcement in court dealing with actual crime and not foreign students who drowned in bureaucracy at the DMV. I don't personally want to give a biometric identifier, it's another real ID Act requirement, like my thumbprint or iris scan to have a driver's license. I don't want to show my papers to have them scanned and retained forever in yet another government database with no tangible benefit. The current system, which requires that you are legal when you apply for your license with none of the additional requirements, strikes a reasonable balance between public safety and privacy and is not broken. Like most other Alaskans, I strongly value my privacy. Other states have started to stand against this opposition. New Hampshire passed New Hampshire House Bill 1582, specifically prohibiting their DMV from implementing these rules, calling them repugnant to Amendments 4 through 10 of the United States Constitution, and I personally agree with that assertion. I'm returning to Juneau tonight, and I'd be more than happy to provide your offices with copies of my speech or to meet any of you for face-to-face discussions, and I'm willing to answer questions. Thank you for considering my testimony today, and I would like to ask you to vote against this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. If you'd like to bring that to your speech by my office, we'll be sure it's distributed to each of the members of finance. So thank you. Senator Huggins?
Thank you, Senator Green. I think Mr. Kerr just explained why we need to do this. You know, this is not the task of the state of Alaska. It's not the task of Hawaii. It's not the task of Florida. It's not the task of the state troopers, the FBI, the CIA. It's all of them. It's all of us. If each of us do our little chipping away, in this case, DMV, doesn't bother me at all that a college student going to UAA every year has to go down and get a new driver's license. I think that probably ultimately, and that's one of the things that we as citizens of this country have to come to grips with, we may in fact walk on the battlefield, and we will notice one of these days, and I think in North Carolina it just happened, where a student rammed through the population there and saying he did it because he didn't like the people there because he thought that they were kin to some people that are killing people of his religious group. That's the real world. And if our DMV and this legislation can in any way discourage or contribute to the capture of somebody that has those sorts of intentions, I'm proud of it. Mr. Kerr, thank you very much for your testimony, and we appreciate your thoughtfulness.
Are there any questions about this legislation? Is there anyone who would like to gather more information about this legislation before we pass it out in committee? Senator Wilson.
Madam Chair, move to report Senate Bill 189 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Without objection, Senate Bill 189 moves from committee with attached recommendation. Fiscal note and individual recommendations. Are there any other issues to come before our committee today? Briefities. Tomorrow, we have legislation ready to be heard in the morning. And Senator Wilkin.
Ma'am, while we just have a moment, I just might let you know that we're going to try to close up our budget subcommittees by next Monday. And so then we'll publish a schedule on the public testimony, which tentatively would be the following Thursday and then Saturday. And then we'll go from there. But we're starting to wrap that up, and I'll publish the schedule here in the next couple of days.
Thank you. Very good. Any other announcements? Finance is adjourned.